This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I recently found out that you can see a personal dietitian covered by insurance. There's this platform called Nourish that will match you with a dietitian based on whatever your concerns are, whether that's weight loss, eating disorders, autoimmune conditions, or something else. They're actually a network with major insurance providers, so most patients pay $0 out of pocket. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
SoCal's Country Station, 95.1 KFrog. I'm Pepper. This is Spirit of the IE. As the international community debates the future of Crimea, a new book offers a deeply human perspective on the indigenous people at the heart of the conflict and their struggle for recognition, justice, and self-determination. On the line to tell us more is cultural anthropologist and author of this book, Decolonizing Ukraine, Greta Euling, PhD. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Euling, start by telling us what led the indigenous people of Crimea to deviate from their decades-long strategy of peaceful and nonviolent resistance to take up arms and blockade Crimea. What were the results of this blockade?
Well, what motivated them to adopt that strategy was that sort of the scale of the damage wreaked by the Russian occupation of Crimea. And, you know, after Russia occupied Crimea in 2014, the international response was quite weak, and many Ukrainians were quite resigned that Russia would control that territory. And being frustrated by that, they took matters into their own hands and blockaded the territory. And the results were that it made electricity approximately 30 times more expensive for Russia. Russia was forced to build an entire, you know, generator system to supply electricity to the Crimean Peninsula. And then another result was that they created a cadre of individuals who kept eyes on the actual administrative boundary lines between these two countries and really improved the treatment for the people that were trying to cross. Previously, the border guards of both states had sort of infringed on people's rights. That was no longer the case after they installed their cadres. So that was it. And I guess the one point that's important is that, you know, while they were, this was like the most aggressive thing that they had done in a long time, but you can understand their logic if you appreciate that, you know, for decades under the Soviet Union, they might have experienced discrimination and forms of repression. But with the Russian occupation of Crimea after 2014, the scale of the violence against them increased dramatically and came to include things like forced disappearances, imprisonment, torture, convictions on false charges, home searches, school searches, very aggressive electronic and cyber surveillance, and all of that persuaded them that they should take firmer measures.
What's the importance of Ukraine regaining Crimea for human rights?
It's very significant. I think that it comes down to what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world that is governed by laws and respect for the sovereignty of independent nation states? Or do we want to live in a world where might makes right and laws are transgressed, you know, depending on your military and political power. I think most people would agree that it would harm everybody to live in the world where, you know, it's survival of the strongest, the most militarily strong. But also there's another dimension of the book, which is, you know, the title, Decolonizing Ukraine, refers to Ukraine's multifaceted process of ridding itself from the effects of Russian domination politically, economically, culturally, and perhaps most importantly, psychologically. So in the book, a major focus is the cognitive dimensions of that process for sort of dismantling erroneous beliefs. And I think that this has relevance regardless of the outcome of the current war, because as a result of the processes of decolonization over the last decade, people who had survived centuries of colonial oppression ceased to see themselves primarily as victims, and they started to think about themselves in a whole new way. This opened up new avenues for collaboration and cohesion across, you know, different sectors of the society. And Ukraine is in now in a far better and more unified position to address its own challenges.
Why might the reintegration of Crimea when territory is reclaimed be difficult? What's in store if Ukraine regains the territory?
Well, you know, it's my hope that it will regain the territory. And I think that it's a really complicated question because the media space in Crimea has been closed off for over a decade now. And that means that the people who live there have been exposed only to disinformation, misinformation propagated by Russia. That has shaped their thinking profoundly. And it's also a very closed off area. It is dangerous to travel there. I myself, because I had U.S. government funding, was told I couldn't go there because that would be, you know, giving that occupation legitimacy. So it's very difficult to travel, and people are quite isolated. And so I think that the Crimean Tatars, in collaboration with the Zelensky administration, has created a couple different bodies, one of which is a permanent forum. There's also a permanent representative to Ukraine within Zelensky's administration. And what they've developed is a plan for, firstly, you know, militarily deoccupying the territory. But then, as you allude to, there's a complex process of decolonizing it through laws, economically, psychologically. And they have a plan for that that includes everything from like a lustration process, which basically just means recognizing any property exchanges that took place illegally during the occupation, you know, making those illegitimate, removing people that had presided over the occupation from their posts, recalibrating the education system so that the children in Crimea can learn a less biased version of history and begin to like rethink their positions on various topics, and then working with the people who live there.
I'm speaking with Dr. Greta Euling, PhD, cultural anthropologist and author of Decolonizing Ukraine. Russia has called the Crimean Tatars terrorists. Is this accurate in your view?
That's a great question. And actually, under Russian law, the definition of a terrorist is so broad as to encompass virtually anything or anyone. So I do not believe that that is an accurate designation. And from the Ukrainians' perspective, including Crimean Tatars, it's Russia that is a terrorist regime. And in fact, this is a designation that the European Union has also made because it's a terrorist regime. And then, of course, we have a long list of war crimes that are being committed by Russia against Ukrainians.
What was it like to visit the barricade by yourself?
You know, I felt surprisingly comfortable there. And I knew that Russia could seek to take that territory with the, you know, after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine that occurred in 2022. But my experience of Ukraine is of a place that's quite different from the United States. I think that, you know, in Ukraine, I always had the sensation that if I fell backwards, somebody would catch me. And I had many, many experiences of complete strangers being ready to help me with directions, help me find a place to stay, many, many experiences over 2 decades. And by contrast, you know, my experience in the United States is that if somebody falls down, somebody's probably going to film it, and somebody else is probably, you know, going to laugh and stare. Like, we live in a very different society here in the United States that, at least in my experience, is less compassionate. And I think that we can trace that back to the experience that Ukrainians had under the Soviet Union, which in that, you know, for those decades, Soviet citizens couldn't rely on their government to protect them in any way. And so they became very reliant on one another for information, sometimes food, sometimes that crucial favor. And I'm not saying that one system is better than another. I'm not trying to say that, oh, the United States is better, the Soviet Union is better. It's useless to make comparisons like that. But what I would say is that Ukrainians are a very compassionate, resilient, creative, and helpful society.
Why should the U.S. continue to send aid and military support to Ukraine?
The U.S. should continue to send aid to Ukraine, firstly, because for moral reasons, right? We promised. We promised in 1994 if Ukraine's territorial integrity was ever violated, we would step in militarily with the Budapest Memorandum that was signed in 1994. So it helps us with our integrity. But there's other more practical and pragmatic reasons as well, which is that greater, you know, actually stepping up our military assistance to Ukraine is the fastest, least costly, and most durable pathway to a sustainable peace. And that means that Ukraine will support food security in the developing world. Once it begins to rebuild, it can protect nuclear security, right? The nuclear power plants in Ukraine have been damaged by the war. So it has to do with our ecological safety, our food security, and of course, our political system. Again, going back to, do we want to live in a rule-governed order or a place where might makes right?
Weren't most people in Crimea happy to see the return of Russian control over the peninsula?
Some people were happy because Ukraine had, in fact, neglected Crimea for a very long time. And I think this is where the indigenous people, the Crimean Tatars, really provide a unique aperture for understanding the war between Russia and Ukraine, because they found themselves sort of wedged between these two countries, neither of which could provide them with much assistance. And so Crimea, under an independent Ukraine, was sort of left to fend for itself, and it was not a very developed place. So when I went there for example, in the late 90s, a lot of people did not have indoor plumbing. Most people did not have a phone in their home. In a lot of neighborhoods, there might be one phone for an entire neighborhood, and people would run to the neighbors to receive a call or make a call. And so I think that the residents of Crimea rightly perceived that Russia would bring economic development, and it made good on that promise, but the cost has been tremendous. Right? It's at the cost of human rights. It's at the cost of freedom of speech. It's at the cost of the surveillance that I mentioned, and now it's at the cost of military conscription, right? So Putin's war machine has been called a meat grinder because of the lack of discretion in terms of the number of men that he's willing to throw at the war against Ukraine. You know, the death toll for Russian soldiers, according to the Ukrainian military that has, you know, counted the number of soldiers that have perished in the war on their own soil, is around 800,000 soldiers, right? So it's just astronomical. And then if we add in the disabilities that have resulted, you know, it's somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 people. So the cost to human life is astronomical, and the loss of civic freedoms, freedom of speech, human rights is also a very hefty cost to pay. I should also mention, in regard to the welcoming of Russian rule in Crimea after 2014, that the Russian news sources had quite a bit of coverage on this topic, that people had voted they had voted to rejoin Russia. And that's simply incorrect because, first of all, on that ballot where they voted, there was no option to vote in favor of remaining part of Ukraine, right? That vote was about two different, like, administrative designations for the place where they were living, both of which were under Russia. So that's the first point there. But then an even more important point is perhaps that those elections were not free and fair. They were carried out under the barrel of a machine gun, and Russia used a number of tactics to shape the vote, including carousels where they bust people around to vote multiple times in the same election. They bust people in from Russia to vote, and they also falsified the results. So what was publicized was a very high turnout and a majority voting in favor of becoming part of Russia. But then actually the president's own human rights office leaked information that actually a much smaller percentage of the population had voted. It was closer to 30% that had voted. And then perhaps half of those people had voted in favor. So we could call, you know, it was an election in name only. It wasn't a really robust expression of the will of the people living in Crimea at the time.
I'm speaking with Dr. Greta Euling, PhD, cultural anthropologist and author of Decolonizing Ukraine. What values and ambitions do Ukrainians and Americans share?
Both Ukrainians and Americans share a very powerful desire for freedom and autonomy and democracy. And I saw that very powerfully after the Ukrainian Revolution of Dignity between 2013 and 2014, where, you know, the government put this drape on the side of a building that said, "Freedom is our religion." They're very, very committed to democratizing their country, fighting corruption. There's been very extensive efforts to eliminate corruption in Ukraine. And then I think also that they value transparency. And the other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, in the process of the Revolution of Dignity, or it's sometimes called the Euromaidan, between 2013 and 2014, Ukrainians began to expand their idea of what it means to be Ukrainian. If in the past they had thought of it primarily in ethnic terms, they started to think of it more in terms of their political values. And so they came up with this much more capacious idea that a Ukrainian can be really any skin color, any religion, any ethnic background. That doesn't matter. What matters is, what are your values and how do you work together as a society? And I think that Americans also share that value, right? The sense that you don't have to be a particular race or religion to be American.
How do racial distinctions work in Ukraine?
You know, that is a really interesting question, because there's been a lot of concern about racism in Ukraine after, you know, there was this incident where some of the black residents of Ukraine were not able to, you know, exit the country when the full-scale invasion broke out. But I think that that was just poor planning in terms of the evacuation efforts. And so race works in a lot of different ways in Ukraine. You couldn't really make a generalization about, you know, all Ukrainians are racist or no Ukrainians are racist. But what I would say is that, having experienced Russian domination, Ukrainians are highly attuned to any group of people or any society that is experiencing similar forms of oppression. And so when Ukrainians look at the United States, they say, aha, Ukraine is to Russia as Black Americans are to America in general, right? Like this idea that when a group of people encounters like this structural violence of systematic oppression over decades that, you know, inhibit them from growing, prospering, they're very empathic with that. And that is like one of the things I think that provided for an opportunity for them to begin to understand the Crimean Tatars within their country as well. Because if before the revolution, Crimean Tatars, you know, they lived in the south of Ukraine. Some of them are darker skinned, not all of them, but they're Muslim. And they were sort of viewed as this renegade element, a people that was less disciplined, less civilized, less educated, and less capable. And then with the revolution and with the internal population displacement of Crimean Tatars from Crimea into the government-controlled parts of Ukraine, all of a sudden they found ways to, well, there were many, many opportunities to interact with each other. And those old stereotypes that were quite inaccurate were dismantled. One of the arguments that I make in the book is that the combination of the revolution and internal displacement provided an opportunity for Muslim and Christian, Crimean Tatar and Slavic Ukrainians to better understand their commonalities and the ways that they could work together.
What have been the environmental consequences of the Russian occupation and annexation on Crimea?
The environmental consequences are enormous, and I am quite surprised that there hasn't been more widespread reporting on this topic. I mentioned the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia being damaged a little bit earlier, but in Crimea, the peninsula was largely turned into, you know, something that's often described as like a giant military base. And that means that military exercises, tanks, test explosions destroy agricultural land. And then also all of the activities in the Black Sea are harming aquatic life. And so at first it was the tests of weapons, and then it was actually the actual detonation of weapons has led to a lot of different kinds of fish kill, especially dolphins, bottlenose dolphins and other dolphins. Their death toll has been catastrophic. And then, of course, many ships have been sunk in the Black Sea, and there is like leakage into the water. So there's chemicals in the water, and then there's the vibrational effects of those weapons going off is all affecting it.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I've been speaking with Dr. Greta Euling, PhD, cultural anthropologist and author of Decolonizing Ukraine. Anything else you want us to know? And also, how would you like us to get your book?
Decolonizing Ukraine is available anywhere books are sold. And we talked a little bit about the main part of the title, Decolonizing Ukraine, referring to Ukraine's, you know, this process of ridding itself of the effects of Russian domination. But I think I also want to talk about the subtitle, because it's about pathways to freedom. And the subtitle operates on a couple different levels. Displacement from Crimea was a literal pathway to freedom for people who fled Russian occupation. And a good part of the book is devoted to the people who disagreed with Russian occupation and left for Ukrainian government-controlled territory. And you know, so people fled to preserve their freedom of speech, their right to have a political opinion, and their freedom of religious expression. But at a deeper level, the pathway to freedom is this process of cognitive deoccupation that I mentioned very briefly, which is a process of freeing your mind from the constraints that others would impose on it, even when you are constrained, whether it's politically or literally in a Russian prison. And I think that, you know, there's a man that has been especially articulate on this particular topic. He actually stayed in Crimea and remained politically active in spite of the risks. And then when he had the opportunity, he traveled to the capital city of Kiev to speak at a high-level meeting about the deplorable human rights situation on the Crimean Peninsula. And when he returned to his home in Crimea, he was immediately arrested and imprisoned on these fabricated charges of terrorism, you know, right, simply for expressing his ideas. And even in prison, he refused to capitulate under very difficult prison conditions and psychological pressure. And he really provided a lot of encouragement for the Crimean Tatars remaining in Crimea. In one address, he encouraged the people on the Crimean Peninsula that, you know, even in a situation lacking freedom, we remain free within. And he encouraged people to never give up the pursuit of freedom. And I feel like at the time he was speaking to his community of Crimean Tatars, and now that we face this juncture in the peace process between Russia and Ukraine, I think it applies to Ukrainians as a whole, right? That they should never give up. And sometimes maintaining your freedom of thought, maybe it's the only thing that you can do, but it's still vitally, vitally important to surviving a really difficult situation.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for helping us to better understand this conflict.
Thank you so much for having me.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.